Session number 8230.
Brigadier Rathbone, tape 5. So could you tell me about your next operation? What did you do after you had all dispersed and gone your separate ways when you went north of Baghdad?
Well, I personally, with my draft, then marched the remaining miles to rejoin the battalion.
And where were they?
They were in, as I say, this Scindia Window picket line, 60 miles north of Baghdad, consisting of lunettes and strong points and so on. We were in no immediate danger of attack. The enemy were at least 60 miles off. So we were just holding this line.
What were conditions like for you then? For instance, was it very hot? It would have been summer at that time.
Appallingly hot. We were in single fly tents, covered with straw matting to keep the heat out. But even so, the heat was intense. It got as high as 132 in the shade. Trying to write a letter with an indelible pencil was hopeless. The liquid spoilt the paper and everything. And an awful trouble then was the Baghdad boil date. We got a boil, and as soon as that was over, they got another one. It was very weakening and disgusting anyway, but it was very universal.
What was that caused through, do you think, the Baghdad boil?
General rundownness, I should think, weakening by the heat and that sort of thing.
Were there cases of dysentery as well and malaria?
Malaria, yes. Not much dysentery that I remember. There was dysentery, but nothing like what there'd been in Gallipoli.
Was that because your conditions were more sanitary, do you think, more hygienic?
Yes, I mean, I can remember the flies were nothing like as bad in Mesopotamia as in Gallipoli, nothing like. What was rather nasty was sandfly fever, which I succumbed to, because to keep sandflies out, you had to have a mosquito net, which was so closely knit that it was stuffy. It's almost better to be bitten by the sandfly than have the mosquito net.
It sounds pretty uncomfortable.
Yes. There was one thing, this great heat in the daytime, but at night it got cool enough just to want to put a blanket over yourself about 2 o'clock in the morning. Whereas if we'd been at Basra, we've had this humid heat all night.
So you were pretty inactive at that time, were you? You
yes.
weren't actually
I
engaged.
We're inactive as regards nothing to do with the enemy.
What was your activity, the other activity you were pursuing then?
Training, organization. I used to try and run concert parties to amuse the troops. Not very easy. So I combed the company for talent, recitations or songs. My own contributions were, said I to my soul, said I, from my Alanthian sparkling eyes from the god Lyrus. Which was better than nothing.
So what move did you make after that position? What was your next sort of operational move?
Ah, well, the 9th Worcesters of the same division relieved us in, was it October? Yes, I think it was, in the Scindia Window picket line. We went back to reserve, and shortly after that we started operations in the direction of Kermanshah towards Persia. Not much resistance. Then we had a winter. Yes, the winter of 1917. We were in a sort of camp under canvas doing training with our new CO, Colonel Harrison of the Somerset Light Infantry. Not a reorganization of training. Then in March, it must have been, it was felt that something ought to be done by the Mesopotamian force to relieve the awful pressure in France, March 1918, however little. So we started off, 38th Brigade, with operations towards Kirkuk and Mosul. I can remember long marches and almost going to sleep on the march sometimes. I can remember crossing difficult rivers, pushing guns and vehicles across. You might be interested in a dinner we had one night after crossing a river called the Khazar Chai. Having seen to the men, they had what rations managed to get up, I said, well, what have we got for dinner? And this was the dinner. Julian soup. Well, we had a little what was practically dust left in our last tin of Julian. Bully beef stew and biscuits and broad beans. The broad beans were from a neighbouring field and rather unripe. Finally, chocolate mould. Well, we had a little powdered chocolate left, one piece of gelatine, no sugar. I did the best we could with that. And then fried biscuits, savoury. Now, in my opinion, having those served decently on ration boxes, course by course, was a good morale reviver. Well, then we continued to push forward. And I well remember the battle, if it deserves the name, of Tuzcamartle. We'd done a complicated and very lengthy detour and a night march, and we appeared where the Turks did not expect us. We very nearly caught the divisional commander, but we found his shaving kit all set out and his tent ready. And I can remember that we fired Lewis guns over men's shoulders because of the standing crops about 4 foot high. And I arrived on top of a hill. It really was a picnic. The Turks were in full flight, bullets buzzing about and so on, but we had very few casualties. And I had the mortification of stopping a gun team by Lewis gunfire at about 1,400 yards, only to see it pinched by the King's Own and flayed as their own capture. And then a pause, and the CO came up. Well done, Rathbone. The two leading companies were A Company Major Craig on the right, B Company Captain R.B. Rathbone on the left. And he said, we've got in body to put forward for an immediate award. I thought, no, sir, I don't think so. Both my subalterns did very well. So did my Sergeant Major, so did Sergeant so-and-so. But I don't think to the extent of, in excess of their gallantry, in excess of their duty. All right, he said. So I missed the chance of an easy DSO. Well then, we continued the advance. Masses of broken vehicles, dead Turks, dying Turks, on the route, evidence of lack of equipment and not much to eat. We got as far as Kirkuk, and they discovered there was some idea of leaving a small force there. But it was eventually decided that the supply difficulties were too great. We'd been 2 or 3 days when only half rations came up. One day, no rations came up. And we had to eat our sacred iron ration, which was a tin of bully beef and a bag of moldy little biscuits. And so we started to march back from Kirkuk. We got pretty near Mosul. And the CO sent the second-in-command ahead to the camp we were going back to and said, whatever else you do, you must have 2 bottles of beer per man when we get there, which he duly did. Meanwhile, we marched 70 miles a day in the very early morning because of the heat. I'd managed to snaffle a hen, which dutifully laid 2 or 3 eggs a day, 3 for breakfast the next day. Oh, I forgot, at this time of severe shortage of rations, we depended quite a lot on sheep that people got. There were various sheep and we just killed them. And had roast mutton, kidneys and that sort of thing, no vegetables, no bread. Tea with no sugar. That didn't matter to me, it mattered to a lot of people. No milk.
Were these food shortages because of the supply lines?
Yes, exactly.
Were so far behind?
Yes, fine.
And they couldn't get the food
couldn't
up?
Cope.
You
no.
had advanced ahead of the supply lines, yeah. I supposed. Yes. How about water? How did you fare for water?
I don't remember any shortage of water. Any number of rivers we crossed.
Were you always very careful to boil the water?
I dare say we weren't always as careful as we should have been. But I can't remember any terrible things happening from failing to do that. There was an extraordinary instance of generosity on the part of my servant who was called Moon. Damn good servant. A passing armoured car, a friend of his chucked him a couple of packets of Scissors cigarettes. Scissors were a great, very popular brand in that World War. And he insisted on giving me a whole packet. I thought that was amazingly generous, because we hadn't had any cigarettes except Arab cigarettes, which were dreadful things, for I don't know how long.
That must have been quite a treat.
It was. Well, eventually we got back to this camp. And there isn't really very much more to tell because the last bit of the war we spent at a little place called Abu Jusra on the line of communications. And we built huts and trained. I can remember after some rain, it created the most extraordinary sticky mud about an inch thick, terribly slippery. And then along came the armistice with Turkey and finally the armistice with Germany. But as I say, if you were stationed in Mesopotamia, you hadn't much chance of seeing England again until the end of the war, unless you got a really bloody wound.
So you must have been away for quite a long time in all then.
3.5 years. As I say, my great fear was that our dog should have died before I got home. But he hadn't. And he remembered me all right.
How would you compare the conditions, the living conditions, in Mesopotamia compared with Gallipoli?
Well, there were no tents in Gallipoli. Whereas in Mesopotamia, when we were not on active operations, there were. So to that extent, we're more comfortable in Mesopotamia. We hadn't got that colossal heat to contend with in Gallipoli. And you had the chance of getting an occasional day or two's leave in Baghdad. Not that there was much to do, but there was a rather scruffy hotel called the Maud Hotel.
You would have spent a couple of Christmases, would you not, in Mesopotamia? Are there any sort of memorable incidents you can remember?
Oh, I never told you about Lord Curzon's champagne. That was in Christmas 1916, when I was wounded on the 15th of December. he made a present of a bottle of champagne per officer and a pint of beer per man in the whole force. Must have cost him a fortune. However, things weren't so bad in those days. And I'd sufficiently recovered from my wound. I was just going down river to be able to partake slightly of the champagne. But I heard afterwards that in distributing the beer, it was a dark night, and the officer who was sort of supervising it, men came up with the canteens, you see, filled up with beer. And this officer noticed after about six chaps had had their work, it looked awfully dark for beer. He found it was rum. He got the beer all right, but the things got mixed up. What happened to the original six who got a whole mess tin full of rum, I don't know. But there we are. I should have mentioned, too, that when I was wounded, a certain Private Allen stopped and looked after me. Well, of course, what I should have done was to tell him to go back to the company and leave me alone. But I was in no condition to do that. I was only too thankful to have him. He came all the way down river with me and finished up as batman to a quartermaster at the base.
Was that very uncomfortable, the journey down river when you were wounded?
No, because by that time I'd recovered. What was uncomfortable was just after I'd been wounded, going first in a horse ambulance and later on in the motor ambulance, bumping over this rough ground, it was agony, to the field ambulance. Oh, there's a funny incident. I was hoping to have shown you my brandy flask. I also had a leather cigarette case and an indelible pencil in this pocket here when I was wounded. And the brandy in the indelible pencil made a large purple stain on my pocket. And I got very tired of the inevitable medical joke, blue blood I see. Through every MO's hands I passed. No, by the time I went down river, I was pretty good. Spent a little time in Bombay in hospital. First in a real hospital, then in a convalescent hospital. And we had with us, there was an Indian Army man and I who sort of got together. And there was a perfectly extraordinary Canadian bird who was in the artillery. We called him Steve. And his language was a mixture of polysyllabic English and backwards Canadian bar slang. The most extraordinary fellow. And he drank more than any man I've ever seen. Never seen the worse for liquor. But his chota hazri, that means a little breakfast in India, it was sort of early morning, very grandiose early morning tea, was a stiff brandy and soda. The number of gin and bitters I saw him drink before lunch when he was playing billiards was 21, I'm not exaggerating. And so on for the rest of the day. He can't have lasted very long. But I remember this Indian Army man, Griffin, and I had been out shopping in Bombay, and we came back to the convalescent hospital. He said, "Say, you fellows," he said, "just when I wanted you, two high flyers going to leave me alone. Do you know what happened today? A lord came to inspect the hospital." I said, "Yes, Lord, no Lord, was that right, boys?" This was Lord Willingdon, who was governor of Bombay at the time. He laughed like hell. So did we. So is all this very irrelevant? We got the news of General Moore's death in January 1918. It was said that he drank a cup of milk at some Jewish festival and got cholera from it. But I don't think the exact truth is known. Of course, his loss was irreparable. Very, very fine soldier. And they were terribly sorry. There were two corps, the first and third, of General Marshall of the third, was selected to be commander-in-chief after that.
Would you say that he made a great deal of difference to the campaign in Mesopotamia, General Maud?
No, because the campaign was not over, but all the tough work and everything was over. It's simply a question of mopping up and further operations.
But so far as organisation was concerned, was he good for that?
Well, first class. But then he'd done all that, you see. Things were on proper wheels and going right now. So it didn't matter so much from that point of view.
You were saying earlier on that one of your main tasks in the trenches, when there was a situation of inactivity, was reorganisation and retraining your troops. Was that according to sort of new laws which had been decided upon, new guidelines?
No, perhaps I made too much of that. I merely meant that if there'd been casualties and so on, or we'd lost an NCO, somebody else had to be made an NCO and that kind of thing.
Just replacement, yes. More, was it? Yes, to keep the strength up.
Documentation and all that. Men's pay books, see if they were kept right.
Did you have this task of writing to relatives when you lost men? Did you have to write letters of, condolence?
I did once or twice, yes.
What did you think about doing that job?
Well, it wasn't very pleasant, of course.
Was it difficult
to find? One tried to make... I've heard since that the best thing you can do if you're writing a letter of condolence is to write something nice and pleasant about the person who's gone. I think that's right.
What was the position of mail from home? Were you still receiving mail and parcels in Mesopotamia?
Yes. We received them all right, but very late. Sometimes 2 months. Oh yes, the mail went on. That's the most important thing for morale in the army, the mail and graves.
And graves?
Yes. It makes a lot of difference to families to know that they're lost sons, nephews, whatever it is, are properly buried. The Imperial War Graves Commission did an extremely good job in Gallipoli and everywhere else, I think. As I say, I went back to Gallipoli 7 years later and found my whole trench and everything, and I had a look at these graves by which... By that time, the War Graves Commission had done quite a lot.
How important was the actual taking of Kut in December 1916, do you think?
Well, as I'd been wounded the previous day, I really don't know and I can't remember what the exact situation is. I know we took Kut either the next day or the day after, but whether there was any resistance, whether there were many Turks left there defending it, I simply can't remember. Anyhow, it wasn't much of an obstacle because the force continued to advance to Baghdad. The next hold-up of any consequence, which I've already mentioned, was on the River Diyala. I would like to make a correction about Port Said. I mentioned some hotel. Its proper name was the Eastern Exchange Hotel.